Good evening. I'm Paul Kennedy with Ideas About Francis Bacon.
I have taken all knowledge to be my province. Ipsa scientia potentis est. Knowledge is power.
We today have very, very strong notions that there is an obvious difference between science on the one hand and scientific knowledge, and politics on the other hand, and political knowledge and perspectives. For Francis Bacon, these were all part of the same set of aspirations and anxieties.
More than any other Englishman, Francis Bacon was a Renaissance man. And also, as we began to learn in part one of this series, a true man of the Renaissance. Impoverished son of a powerful politician in Elizabethan England, Francis was forced to fight and earn his way to the top. He served time as a spy. He worked his way up the legal ladder and eventually became counselor at the court of Queen Elizabeth I. Tonight, we pick up the story where we left off last time. We'll follow Francis Bacon through his political rise and permanent fall from power. And we'll once again try to connect the snakes and ladders of a complicated public career with the mind of a man who's often been called the father of modern science, Francis Bacon.
He didn't have children, and he fell out of sight. And the writings became his way of telling himself that posterity was in conversation with him, even if the court wasn't. In an extraordinary way, he managed the chameleon task of being the figurehead of intellectual life under the Commonwealth and the figurehead of intellectual life under the Restoration. No wonder he can be adapted to almost anybody's needs.
Our persons live in the view of heaven, yet our spirits are included in the caves of our own complexions and customs, which minister unto us infinite errors and vain opinions, if they be not recalled to examination. I have lost much time with this age. I would be glad to recover it with posterity.
My name's Julian Martin. I'm professor of history at the University of Alberta, and I am also the editor of several of the volumes of the new Oxford Complete Works of Francis Bacon. Much of Francis Bacon's writing is for a very small audience. Much of it, in fact, remained in manuscripts. And it's only by going through his manuscripts that I have been able to piece together some of the continuities in his work. And when he wrote many of his policy documents, and he wrote many, many, many of them during Queen Elizabeth's reign, they were written for privy councillors and for a relatively select circle of influential men in London. So he again is concerned to influence the opinions of people who have the levers of power. And he is not very interested in becoming what we today might regard as an author. It is true that in 1597 he does print a little book called The Essays. But this is a rare thing for him. He very rarely consciously sets out to print a book. That is not his enterprise. His enterprise is to influence the influential directly and in a way that was meaningful to them. This, of course, still being a period in which going into print is slightly disagreeable and offends the sensibilities of gentlemen entirely. So much of his work is designed for small audiences, particular audiences. And that is why, again, I think it appropriate to see him as a politician rather than as a scholar.
I'm Stephen Gorkroger. I'm Professor of History of Philosophy and History of Science at the University of Sydney, Australia. And I recently completed a book called Francis Bacon and the Transformation of Early Modern Philosophy. He thinks that there is a political vindication of natural philosophy, that it's not just a waste of public money when people could be doing other more productive things. So he brings out how productive it is. He brings out how a training in these things could be important for statesmen and others, that there were intellectual and practical people in antiquity, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and he produces a list. He also thinks that natural philosophy has a very particular payoff, and this is the extension of life in human beings. He criticizes the medicine of his day on the grounds that it's only dealing with diseases. It doesn't concern itself with preventative measures, whereas what natural philosophy should do is concern itself with preventative measures, and and in particular, it should examine what the causes of aging are. So, for example, if you look at plants, you find that plants don't actually age. I mean, they die ultimately, but they don't go through a period of old age where, you know, things dry up over a long period. And he wonders why this happens in plants and not in human beings, for example. Note he's not after a philosopher's stone. He's not after something that will transform human beings from the kind of thing that ages into the kind of thing that doesn't age, like alchemists were doing. It's much more practical than that. He's saying we can slow down the aging process. The aging process is a purely natural process. By studying natural philosophy, by looking at precisely what the aging process consists in, whether it's drying up of fluids or whatever, we can put in place procedures to slow this down. So he tries to vindicate or legitimate natural philosophy on a number of different fronts. And this, I think, was to be one of the respects in which he was particularly influential in the 17th century.
For most of his life, Francis Bacon was preoccupied with prolonging that life. And near the end of his life, Bacon spent much of his energy promoting his posthumous reputation. He never seemed to achieve the fame or the fortune that he felt he deserved. His father, Sir Nicholas Bacon, had been Lord Keeper of the Great Seal of England. But Francis, for many reasons, found it difficult to rise through the ranks of the court of Queen Elizabeth. One of the main reasons was a man named Essex. The Earl of Essex was Elizabeth's favorite. His circle of friends included the best and the brightest of Elizabethan society. Francis Bacon and his talented brother Anthony believed that they belonged in such a circle.
I'm Alan Stewart. I'm co-authored Hostage to Fortune, The Troubled Life of Francis Bacon with Lisa Jardine, and I'm editor of a new edition of Bacon's Correspondence for OUP. Essex was Elizabeth's favourite in the last years of her reign, and a young man about Bacon's age. He seems to have been a very charismatic man, a man of great ambition, a man of great passion as well, often doing things very impetuously and then regretting them at his leisure, under house arrest, later. And it seems that Bacon actually hitched himself to Essex quite early on. There's a letter in 1588 which suggests they were close even at that point. But during the 1590s, Essex was trying to build a power base to rival that of Sir Robert Cecil. And he did this by collecting people around him who were intellectuals, basically. He employed the kind of secretariat which was not simply pen pushers. One of them was the Regius Professor of Greek from Oxford. He just matched his Oxford salary and stole him and put him in his secretariat. People like Henry Savile and Henry Wotton, who become names in their own rights. Bacon, Anthony and Francis Bacon are part of this circle, but they're never salaried part of the circle. Their position is always somewhere between friends and followers. And that's a dangerous place to be, because you're at once associated with Essex, which can be dangerous, but you are not on salary from Essex. You don't get anything positive from it when things go wrong. And Francis keeps switching, particularly in the latter years of the 1590s when Essex gets into trouble with the Queen. Bacon is always looking at the Queen and at Essex and trying to decide which one he needs to serve first. And of course the answer should be the Queen. And he always goes with the Queen. That makes him look very unsympathetic, because when Essex is tried, as he is a couple of times, Bacon is there on the prosecution team. But of course he's only doing his duty as the Queen's learned counsel. But he is prosecuting his friend. He realised that was an impossible situation, and he tried desperately to justify himself. But it really is a very clear example of how difficult it was to be someone's friend in that sort of highly charged political environment when you're also a subject of the Queen, and that she has to be your first priority.
Lisa Jardine, Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London, author of Francis Bacon, Discovery and the Art of Discourse, and co-author with Alan Stewart of Hostage to Fortune, general editor of the complete Oxford Francis Bacon, Works of Francis Bacon. What you have to understand about Essex and his circle is they really were the bad boys. I mean, they really were a charismatic circle, who were too young for what they were asking for, who had the Queen's favour, and who were going for broke. I think that's in a sense what it feels like. If you were in their train, you therefore went for the top jobs. If Essex had pulled it off, we'd be looking at a most extraordinary second generation. Elizabeth lived far too long. Her elder statesmen were far too elderly. There was a need for the rising generation to take their place, and Essex was the focus for that attempt. He failed, and therefore Bacon's aspirations look outrageously excessive, but that's because it didn't work.
I think we perhaps misunderstand what to be a favourite means. We see the favourite as someone who gets what they want, but in fact the favourite was also the person who was the biggest threat to the monarch, and that's definitely the case with the Earl of Leicester, who was Essex's predecessor in many ways, and with Essex himself. When Essex did get his moment of glory, it was to lead an army into Ireland, which of course means that he is suddenly a young, charismatic leader with a military force behind him, which terrified Elizabeth, giving military might to the one person who could possibly succeed her or overthrow her. And given that Essex did stage a rebellion, her fears are not ridiculous. He entered the city of London in February 1601 and wanted to go to the court. That's what he was going to do. And that's something which she always feared would happen. And she was quite right to.
Francis Bacon didn't take part in the Essex Rebellion. In fact, as legal advisor to Queen Elizabeth, he led the prosecution against his apparently former friend, which hasn't won him many fans among biographers. But Bacon, quite frankly, was only doing his job, and political fortunes rose and fell rather precipitously in early 17th century England, as Bacon himself was soon to learn. He knew the rules of the game. As early as 1597, he'd published his feelings on seditions and troubles in the first edition of his famous essays.
Shepherds of people had need know the calendars of tempests in state, which are commonly greatest when things grow to equality, as natural tempests are greatest about the equinoxes. But as there are certain hollow blasts of wind and secret swellings of seas before a tempest, so are there in states. Ille etiam sicos instabe tumultus sipie monet, fraudesque et operata tumescere bella.
The sun often gives warning of dark rebellions imminent, of treachery and hidden warfare brewing. As if fame were the relics of seditions past, but they are no less indeed the preludes of seditions to come. Howsoever, he noteth it right that seditious tumults and seditious fame differ no more but as brother and sister, masculine and feminine. Also, as Machiavelli noteth well, when princes that ought to be common parents make themselves as a party and lean to a side, it is as a boat that is overthrown by uneven weight on the one side. For when the authority of princes is made but an accessory to a cause, kings begin to be put almost out of possession. And when discords and quarrels and factions are carried openly and audaciously, it is a sign. The reverence of government is lost. So when the pillars of government are shaken or weakened, men had need pray for fair weather and good laws.
Francis Bacon was very, very concerned to pursue reform of the law. Now, one may think this rather bland topic, but it ultimately is extremely important for the way we understand the aspiration to reform the pursuit of natural knowledge. Francis Bacon's remarks on reforming the law books are designed quite explicitly, as we find out from his private letters. They are designed to harness and indeed shackle the ability of royal judges to make what he believes are wayward interpretations of the law of the land. Because law, of course, is largely a matter of interpreting and reading between the existing lines rather than just reading off a rule from a book. And so the power and influence of judges is very great indeed. And Francis Bacon is extremely worried about the public policy implications of that process. In other words, judges, in his view, are voluntaries, and they need to be harnessed, just like everybody else who has pretensions to make statements about true knowledge.
What he wants to do is to reshape philosophers. And I think probably the most important model he has in mind is that of lawyers. He wants to make philosophers practical in the way that lawyers are practical. And he wants natural philosophy to contribute to the public good in a way that he thinks law, or at least a suitably reformulated law, contributes to the public good. And he wants both of them ultimately to be under the authority of a sovereign, or the king, or the queen in the case of Elizabeth, just as he feels that the sovereign is the ultimate adjudicator in the case of the law. He thinks that the sovereign should be the ultimate adjudicator or controller in the case of natural philosophy, because he sees philosophy now as becoming part of a national program. The law is certainly one crucial ingredient in Bacon's thinking about these things. He was also, of course, a statesman. He was involved in large-scale organization at a state level, but strangely enough, his plans for natural philosophy, his organizational plans for natural philosophy, were always very impractical. And he himself never showed any practical initiative in setting up the kind of things that he recommended. So, for example, Bacon's uncle had set up Gresham College, which was a college for natural philosophy in England, where natural philosophy was taught, it was pursued experimentally. Bacon, in all his plans for setting up what he calls a Solomon's House, that's to say somewhere where experiments can be performed in a regulated way, never once mentions Gresham College.
In Francis Bacon's day, there was, of course, no set notion of what constituted the proper procedures and protocols for examining nature adequately. You know, virtually no mention whatsoever in any writings he did before perhaps the age of 60 of anything which we today might regard as logic, or philosophy of science, as we now teach it in the universities. Now, Francis Bacon in the 1580s had been employed in the security service of the state, And during the Great War with Spain, which people will remember perhaps for the Spanish Armada in 1588, the Great War went on for a very long time and was characterized by many assassination attempts on Queen Elizabeth. And so the security service of the state was very active indeed, and young Francis was involved consistently in the interrogation of Jesuits in particular, and saw, as a result, the extreme importance for the state of having a very careful method of interrogating such witnesses and prisoners and sifting the truth content of the things that they said. And so in the early 1590s, we see in Francis Bacon's writings a very careful attempt to specify how one can go about finding truth through certain procedures for inquiry and for sifting those first-order investigations in a hierarchy that eventually results in some hypotheses and general principles. Now, there were no other resources from which to model this approach than the one which, in fact, Francis Bacon knew best of all, the technical business of being a lawyer and the rather grim but equally technical business of interrogating state prisoners. These, then, I think, are the intellectual resources from which Francis Bacon, later in life, specifies the protocols for the investigation and, indeed, as he says, the interrogation of nature.
Nature is often hidden, sometimes overcome, seldom extinguished. Force maketh nature more violent in the return. Doctrine and discourse maketh nature less importune, but custom only doth alter and subdue nature. He that seeketh victory over his nature, let him not set himself too great nor too small tasks, for the first will make him dejected by often failings, and the second will make him a small proceeder, though by often prevailings. And at the first, let him practice with helps, as swimmers do with bladders or rushes, but after a time, let him practice with disadvantages, as dancers do with thick shoes, for it breeds great perfection if the practice be harder than the use. When nature is mighty, and therefore the victory hard, the degrees had need be. First, to stay and arrest nature in time, and lastly, to discontinue altogether. But if a man have the fortitude and resolution to enfranchise himself at once, that is the best.
On Ideas Tonight, you are listening to the concluding episode in a two-part series on the Elizabethan Englishman who, more than any other person, deserves the epithet Renaissance Man, Francis Bacon. I'm Paul Kennedy. Francis Bacon's fortune changed abruptly when Queen Elizabeth died and James I ascended the throne. He was knighted by the king as part of the coronation celebrations. He was appointed first Solicitor General, and then Clerk of the Star Chamber, and finally Lord Keeper of the Great Seal of England. With such a busy political life, the man whom many call the father of modern science found little time for experiments or other scientific work.
Once James came to the throne in 1603, I think Bacon found a milieu which was more his scene. James surrounded himself with young men, usually young, pretty Scottish men. And it was a very different regime. There was no longer the need to court Elizabeth in the same way. And I think that Bacon just felt more at home, not necessarily in direct relationship to James, which took a long time to mature, but in picking up with James's favourites. He understood how to pay court to them, and they understood how they had to please the king. And James was also much more free with his rewards. I mean, the knighthoods, everyone was knighted within about 5 years, whereas Elizabeth had made virtually no one a knight for years on end. So everyone rose under James, it could be said. And certainly Bacon is one of those. But I think it's just a very different setting suddenly. And he learnt how to play that much better.
I like the idea that everybody rose under James, because in a way that's why it's a snakes and ladders, because it's like the stock market, it couldn't go up forever, and therefore people did become actually quite accustomed to the bumpy ride that rise came with obligations, and they were absolute. I mean, this was not, there was no messing around with this. If he asked you to do something, you did it. If you didn't do it, somebody discovered that there was a gold bar in your briefcase, you know, that there'd be a corruption charge instantly. And given you were, in a sense, all corrupt, it was all too like a autocratic state today, you know, there's a particular way in which the meshing of indebtedness and obligation, Bacon knew how to play it, but it was a very tricky game to play, and it doesn't end with any winners.
Bacon was far from unique. I think while we might want to see his rise and fall as some sort of poetic justice, everyone was rising and they all fell. So the Earl of Somerset fell, even though he was James's utter favourite. Sir Edward Cook, who was Bacon's great rival, fell. Sir Lionel Cranfield fell. The Duke of Buckingham fell. And Bacon was just one. He was March 1621's offering. Someone had to go in March 1621, so he went. And I think you can spend far too much time worrying about the details of why he fell and worrying about bribery and corruption. It was just a matter that it was his turn. And he had done things wrong like everyone had done things wrong.
It was prettily devised of Aesop. The fly sat upon the axle tree of the chariot wheel and said, "What a dust do I raise?" So there are some vain persons that whatsoever goeth alone or moveth upon greater means, if they have never so little hand in it, they think it is they that carry it. That they are glorious must needs be factious, for all bravery stands upon comparisons. They must needs be violent to make good their own vaunts. Yet certainly there is use of this quality in civil affairs. Where there is an opinion and fame to be created either of virtue or greatness, these men are the trumpeters.
One of the most celebrated features of Francis Bacon's own career and biography was his fall from political grace in the great machinations of the Parliament of 1620-21. And certainly he does fall from power. He takes the fall for his king and the king's favorite. And when he falls, certainly his political aspirations seem to fall with him too. And yet, in his forced retirement, Francis Bacon is engaged with two thoughts. One, I will be coming back to power soon. And secondly, that I now have the opportunity to work up some of those treatises and sets of experiments that I've been hankering to look at for years now but have been too busy. So we see him in the early 1620s engaged in a long series of experimentations, which result ultimately, after his death, in a book of 1,000 experiments. And we also see him engaged, as ever, in writing foreign and domestic policy statements for the king and the king's eyes only.
The strategy in adversity was to try to recoup the science and extract it from the messy political life. It was also an attempt to extract his life from the reign of James I. I think that Englishmen were more conscious than we have been of the muddying of the waters between the various levels of life under James, a kind of breaking up of the decorum of Elizabeth's reign. Elizabeth's reign had been a very old-fashioned reign, and I think you could sustain many personae. But James's was a really mucky, dirty regime in which your personal life got dragged into your public life, and you were probably, I suspect, being blackmailed for things that you'd done in this rather rich and colourful private world around James. What we remember is things like monopolies, that everybody was getting backhanders under James, that the fall for grace for corruption, everybody was being corrupted with bribes and come-ons and backhanders. So I have a feeling that when you look at Bacon trying to separate his scientific self from his fallen from grace political self, it's also an attempt to get back to those 1590s days where, with the Earl of Essex, they were doing science and they were being diplomats and intelligencers, and it didn't have the kind of nasty taste to it.
Studies serve for delight, for ornament, and for ability. The chief use for delight is in privateness and retiring. For ornament is in discourse, and for ability is in the judgment and disposition of business. But expert men can execute and perhaps judge of particulars one by one, but the general counsels and the plots and marshalling of affairs come best from those that are learned. To spend too much time in studies is sloth. To use them too much for ornament is affectation. To make judgment wholly by their rules is the humour of a scholar. They perfect nature and are perfected by experience. For natural abilities are like natural plants that need pruning by study, and studies themselves do give forth directions too much at large, except they be bounded in by experience. Crafty men condemn studies, simple men admire them, and wise men use them, for they teach not their own use, but that is a wisdom without them and above them won by observation. Read not to contradict and confute, nor to believe and take for granted, nor to find talk and discourse, but to weigh and to consider.
Francis Bacon is generally regarded as one of the fathers of modern science, and it's widely believed that most of his scientific writings date from the period after his fall from power, when his forced retirement allowed him the luxury of leisure time in which he could experiment and think and write. But Bacon had been dabbling in science throughout his life. In fact, we can't really understand Baconian science if we don't simultaneously consider Bacon's public career as a politician and a statesman. He was a Renaissance man, and a true man of the Renaissance.
We today have very, very strong notions that there is an absolutely obvious difference between science on the one hand and scientific knowledge, and politics on the other hand, and political knowledge and perspectives. For Francis Bacon, these were all part of the same set of aspirations and anxieties. And we often fall into the trap, I think, of importing into the past our own taken for granted values. So we tend to think of Francis Bacon as if he were a philosopher of science, and we tend therefore to apply those kind of analyses to his work and inevitably find him wanting. But in fact, he wasn't a philosopher of science. He was a political creature, and everything that he thought and wrote about was converted into grand political terms and categories. His view of why you bother to investigate nature is ultimately that it will serve the state. So on every level, his aspirations can be seen as political ones. So his notion of why we do scientific inquiry is very different than our own. Or perhaps that's not true, in that he prophesied and pleaded with his readers that the best way to organize science for productive purposes was to put all of it in the hands of the government. that independent investigators were very dubious people indeed, that the state is the entity that deserves the product, and it's only through state management and a bureaucracy of all the intellectual labor involved that you can produce significant worthy effects. Well, that was very striking in his day, but certainly it maps rather well with what we see around us today.
One of the ways in which Bacon wants to reform philosophers is to transform them from people who simply sit around and contemplate philosophical problems by themselves. He wants to transform them into members of an active workforce. Part of the plan for doing this is that you must purge the mind of various kinds of natural inclinations and intuitions and prejudices and things that normally inform our mentality. If you can purge the mind of these, you can train up natural philosophers against their natural inclinations to do things that they, if you like, wouldn't otherwise have done, like experiment properly and things like that. Now, that's anathema to the traditional conception of the philosopher, who's a completely independent, autonomous agent. And indeed, what's distinctive about the philosopher, as opposed to the soldier or the clergyman or the statesman, is indeed their autonomy and their independence, their free-mindedness, so to speak. Bacon thinks that you have to undermine that if you are to train up a proper body of natural philosophers. Now, of course, philosophers resisted this. It posed a very serious identity problem for philosophers, for philosophy, and the humanities generally in the 17th century, and I think it posed a problem from which those areas have not really recovered. There's a serious crisis in the humanities, perhaps, that manifests in this break between the sciences and the humanities that begins to take off in the 17th century that had never been there earlier. And Bacon is really at the forefront of that split.
We often do speak about the scientific revolution and presume that people in those days saw these events as a scientific revolution as well. I think we need to remind ourselves that the most significant revolutions of this period were precisely in the relationship of the central government to the lives of other forms of government, namely feudal lords, great bishops, and other great landowners. The great upheavals of the 16th and 17th century are, on the one hand, about the great Christian confessional, whether it would be Protestant or Catholic, but I think more generally they are upheavals about where sovereignty lies, where governance lies. And we see the development of a seemingly modern centralized apparatus for administration, for taxation, and for policy making. And it's in that context that we should locate the upheavals and intellectual ferment that we choose to identify as the scientific revolution. What's at stake is who will own this knowledge, how it will be generated, how it will be promulgated, and what will be the status of the people involved in the inquiries. Are they independent of the state, or do they work for the state? And we see in the 17th century these questions very much at the forefront of the thinking and the writings of many of the people we regard as great early scientists. That was the problem that needed answering. Not merely the content of nature's secrets, but who would own it and who would get to be the investigators.
It has been an opinion that the French are wiser than they seem, and the Spaniards seem wiser than they are. But howsoever it be between nations, certainly it is so between man and man. For as the apostle saith of godliness, having a show of godliness but denying the power thereof, So certainly there are points of wisdom and sufficiency that do nothing or little. It is a ridiculous thing and fit for a satire to see what shifts these formalists have and what perspectives to make superficies to seem body that hath depth and bulk. Some are so close and so reserved as they will not show their wares but by a dark light, and seem always to keep back somewhat. And when they know within themselves, they speak of what they do not well know, and would nevertheless seem to others to know of that which they will not well speak. Some help themselves with countenance and gesture, and are wise by signs. Some whatsoever is beyond their recall will seem to despise or make light of it as impertinent or curious, and so would have their ignorance seem judgment. To conclude, there is no decaying merchant or inward beggar hath so many tricks to uphold the credit of their wealth as these empty persons have to maintain the credit of their sufficiency.
One of Bacon's criticisms of the scholastic tradition of doing natural philosophy was that it was completely unproductive. It was concerned purely with arguments. It was concerned, in Bacon's view, with winning arguments, not with producing knowledge. Bacon takes exception to the adversarial tone of scholastic disputations about natural philosophy. He mentions at one point that he would rather convince people not by disputation, but by, I think he says, a chalk and board, so that people can kind of compromise and work things out amongst themselves. So he's completely against what he sees as this tradition of winning arguments, and much more in favor of some kind of collective project. And this is part of what is involved in his idea that we must follow a via media. We must not take extremes in either position, because this is not how natural philosophers should behave. This is the way scholastics behave. It's not the way he wants natural philosophers to behave. He wants them to engage in public cooperative enterprises, not in solitary adversarial disputes amongst one another. And secondly, he thinks this is not the way for natural philosophy to be pursued, because these adversarial disputes don't actually produce any goods at the end of it. And that, he thinks, is the only worth of natural philosophy. Ultimately, that's the testing ground of natural philosophy. Does it produce anything? If it doesn't, it's no good. It doesn't matter who's won the arguments, it's whether it produces anything.
He was utterly committed to a program of centralization, of strengthening social and political hierarchy, of wrestling independent authority away from those who had it and giving it to the crown. He is observant of what is happening on the continent in his day. The centralization programs of Spain and France are very much on his mind. And he sees that however much these countries can be dangerous to England, he also sees that they're extremely powerful precisely because they have managed to monopolize the machinery of governance. And he wishes very much to see that in England as well. Now, allied to this public policy aspiration is a set of values that he held with respect to the sources of true knowledge. So we see a strong emotion in Bacon to make sure that all things are done in a bureaucratized way, that only those licensed to speak can be regarded as uttering truths, whether it's about the natural world or God's spiritual aspirations for us. It will require hierarchy and close control. In affairs of natural science, he believes that only through state control and management can we mount substantive research programs that can produce substantive results. And so he is very much opposed on nearly every level to many of the things we today will hold dear as proper and responsible values in intellectual matters. He is an utterly Renaissance man in this respect.
Francis Bacon died on Easter Sunday, 1626, slightly more than 5 years after his fall from power. During those 5 years, he'd lived at Gorhambury, a country estate not far from London, where he conducted experiments and performed what he called interrogations of nature. The gardens at Gorhambury were famous in their day. Bacon collected plants and likely practiced botany. Almost nothing remains. After Bacon's death, his house fell into disrepair, and his gardens grew completely wild. His legacy was not appreciated until much later.
The story is that Bacon was on his way back from London to Gorhambury, and he got to Highgate Hill and thought, oh, I can discover, I think maybe there's a connection between refrigeration and keeping substances fresh. So he decided he would find a chicken, which he did, and stuffed it with snow. And then he caught a chill and died in the house of the Earl of Arundel in Highgate. And that's the story, and I think people like that story because it seems to be about getting to your end of your life and still being interested in these great ideas about the properties of ice, for example. But the trouble with that story, well, there are many. Bacon had been doing experiments like that for years, and there are plenty of mentions of that sort of experiment in his writing. And it was April. You don't get much snow in Highgate in April. It's a very convenient story that was told after his death, and in fact Bacon himself tells a very different story in a letter he writes, the last letter we have from Bacon, where he writes to the Earl of Arundel, his host, although the Earl of Arundel's in prison at the time. Bacon seems to have taken refuge in this house, and he actually explains in that letter, in a rather coded manner, exactly what happened to him that brings him to be dying in the Earl of Arundel's house.
My very good lord, I was likely to have had the fortune of Caius Plinius the Elder, who lost his life by trying an experiment about the burning of the mountain Vesuvius. But I also was desirous to try an experiment or two, touching the conservation and strengthening of bodies. As for the experiment itself, it succeeded excellently well. But in the journey between London and Highgate, I was taken with such a fit of vomiting as I knew not whether it were the stone, or some surfeit, or cold, or indeed a touch of all three. But when I came to your lordship's house, I was not able to go back, and therefore was forced to take up my lodging here, where your housekeeper is very careful and diligent about me, which I assure myself your lordship would not only pardon towards him, but think the better of him for it. For indeed your lordship's house was happy to me, and I kiss your noble hands for the welcome which I am sure you give me to it.
So his letter to the Earl of Arundel is a letter of apology. Remember, he doesn't know he's going to die. So it's rather it's a humorous letter. It actually is strongly ironical about what's happened to him, because Bacon believes it to be, if not trivial, he's survived it. And what he says to the Earl of Arundel is that he was returning from London with his physician when he was overtaken on the road by an uncontrollable and violent fit of vomiting, so violent that he had to take refuge, fortunately, in the house of a friend, that he had been in bed since then, and that he had almost succumbed to the fate of Pliny the Elder on the slopes of Vesuvius. The implication being, fortunately, he hadn't succumbed. Well, unfortunately, a couple of days later, he did succumb. He actually died. Now, that's very, very specific, that the Earl of Arundel would have known, as well as Bacon, that Pliny the Elder died on the slopes of Vesuvius inhaling toxic sulfur-based and nitre-based fumes from the volcano, which corroded his lungs and killed him. Bacon is telling us that he has been undergoing the kind of treatment that he actually explicitly proposes elsewhere in his writings, which is supposed to put you to rights if you are, as he was, already quite gravely ill. He'd been ill for 18 months. He'd written his will. He'd adjusted his affairs. He was a sick man, and that he had been attempting some therapeutic cure of inhaling probably a nitre-based product and probably heated. He suggests that, and it is of course true, that inhaling the fumes of a substance has a quicker effect on the system than actually taking it orally. The problem with the kinds of substances that they were using, chemical compounds, is that they tended, just like drugs today, to be cut with impurities or not to be in pure form. And the most likely thing is that instead of being therapeutic on the system, it actually ate away his intestine, and that was what was happening to him. He was vomiting because of caustic effect on his esophagus, and that he then later succumbed to the toxic properties in his stomach.
Well, he was mourned to the extent that his wife left it 10 days before she remarried. I don't think he was much mourned at all. In fact, one of the oddest things researching the last moments of Bacon's life is that no one bothers to mention he's died. I went through endless correspondence of people where you'd think it would be at least a subject of some mild gossip that the man who only 5 years before had been Lord Chancellor had died, and very few people mention it. So I think by that point, he had dropped out of, for other people, he had dropped out of political life. It's difficult from his own writings to substantiate that, because he was still writing to the great and the good. He still wanted to be seen as part of that. But whether writing to King Charles means you're actually really in correspondence with King Charles is another matter. And it may be that by this time Bacon really had been sidelined. His punishment had included not being able to go within 12 miles of the court. In a political society which was based on access, physical access to the people in power, that was social death. So it may be that he just wasn't much mourned at the time. Later on, and particularly on the continent, people started to write about him. But the immediate reaction in London, I think, was fairly muted.
Bacon in the 1620s certainly believed he was writing for posterity. His work had not been taken up in England at all. It had been ignored. After his impeachment, he basically moved to the country, so to speak, and started rewriting his natural philosophical work and trying to present it in a more detailed way. Also, he had had things like the Advancement of Learning translated. He translated it into Latin in the form of the Novum Organon. So he's moving from English to Latin versions of his works to some extent, because he wants his reputation to be established on the continent, because England has just proved not to be fertile ground. Bacon always thought his reputation would be established after time. It's not clear on what grounds. In some respect, particularly his writings on the organization of science, these writings are very much those of a dreamer rather than of someone practical. And it's perhaps characteristic of a dreamer that he's going to think that his time's going to come afterwards if it hasn't come now.
On Ideas Tonight, the concluding episode of Francis Bacon. Selections from the work of Francis Bacon were read by Juan Chiorin. Thanks also to Stephen Gaukroger, Lisa Jardine, Julian Martin, and Alan Stewart. Special thanks to Steve Starcheff. Francis Bacon was written and produced by me, Paul Kennedy, with technical production by Dave Field. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 for the hourly news, followed by the Arts Today and Between the Covers. You're listening to CBC Radio 1, News and More.